So, if you're anything like Axel, you're probably on your fourth D&D campaign and are really struggling to generate new NPC names. Or maybe you're like me and you just insist on giving names to every single one of your space marines. Or maybe you're having a baby here soon and you're sick and tired of all those boring baby naming books. Well then, I'd suggest you pick up Naming Your Little Geek by Scott Rubin, a perfect compendium of names from all over pop culture, complete with brief character synopses, origins, and root words. A fascinating read on its own, but really useful if you're trying to find a non-pun name for your Wi-Fi. Use the link in our description below and get naming. Hello and welcome to Geeks of Grimdark, your home for everything Warhammer, be they elves or Eldar, space marines or Stormcast, we've got you covered. I'm Lord Commander Orc, and with me as always is...
His shield brother, Axel Wright.
How's it going today, man?
I am very tired. I don't have any particular reason for being so tired. Don't look at me, I don't know. But how are you doing?
It has been a very long day. I bought a new couch today, and when I started the moving process, it was raining a little. By the time I got the couch to my house, it was coming down in sheet.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, gotta love this Washington weather of it's gonna rain today, and you're just gonna have to deal with it.
As much as I love our small talk, I think we got a banger of an episode, so we get right into our privilege of our patrons.
Yeah, the people that allow us to have these fun little banters. They are Pam Galley, Mark E., Chris Shimon, River Galley, Krug, Arthur Crane, Kevin A., Brendan Agnew, John Vinnels, Kit Kenny, Seth Decker, Dona Lucy, Carson Mills, Scott Rimmel, Derek Tagati, and Peter Cook. Now, if you'd like to join the Illustrious Legion, get access to this episode in particular early, head on over to patreon.com/geekswithshields. But that's enough, you know, dancing around the bush. Let us go ahead and introduce the guest, which if you haven't figured out from the title, it's Graham McKenna.
Good evening. How you guys doing?
I believe this marks your third appearance with us, right, Graham?
Yeah, I think so. I was thinking two or three, but yeah.
We talked after False Gods. We talked after Fulgrim, if I remember correctly.
Wow, yeah. That was not yesterday.
It's been a while.
But anyways, we're here to take a break from the heresy and talk about Graham's other love, the Old World. Because, hey, it's back. And hey, guess who got to headline the first book in the new-ish old world?
Everything that was old is now new again.
It's all time is cyclical.
And that book for those who don't know, right, is Lords of the Lance. I was not able to get my hands on a copy. Ulrich was, I believe.
This is a very hard. I got lucky. The only reason I was able to get this book is my local hobby shop, when they put in the order for their old world stuff, they got this one, and then someone canceled on them. So like, hey, we knew you wanted this. Do you still want it? And like, yes, you have no idea. It's sold out everywhere.
Oh, that's good to hear. You know, sad for the people who want a copy, but yay for the...
That's me. Know,
selling out.
Yeah, sad for me. I'll get it eventually.
It's a really, really good book. And not to blow smoke up your ass, Graham, this is probably your best fantasy one so far.
Excellent. Thank you for saying so. I was very proud of it and pleased when it was done for all the right reasons.
Yeah, for folks at home, if you're kind of on the fence, and the reason I say this is the best, is this is combining all your strengths of, it's got your great kind of cosmic-y, creepy horror stuff, it's got your great action stuff, it's got your great character beats. It
okay, cleans one me. Sec, Ulrich. I think you've gotten a little ahead of the cart. First of all, if you're listening to this, we're just going to assume you know at least what Warhammer is. There's a base level of knowledge we're
assuming. I'm not. We've done so many of these. Please stop treating this as your first episode.
But admittedly, we've mostly covered 40K, like extensively. So this is a little new-ish, at least for our stuff. Now, we've talked about fantasy, we've talked about the end times, we've talked about Age of Sigmar, and we've talked about a lot of fantasy stuff related to Total War. But the old world itself, at least in this context, is a little bit of a new thing, so... Graham, since you wrote the book, why don't you give a light breakdown of what the old world in this context means?
Yeah. I mean, like, and for another reason, like I say, it's been, 10 years nearly since the old world last had any novels written about it. So there's a lot of people have come into the hobby and the books who probably never played or knew much about the old world. So, the old world is... fantasy, you know, it's a grim grim world of perilous adventure, loosely Tolkien inspired in the sense of you have the elves, the dwarves, the orcs, the humans, and so on. But it's a far, far bleaker place than that, you know, something that sprang from the imaginings of people stuck on a rain-soaked island of grimness at the time. So yes, while you have the sort of staples of fantasy, it's given that uniquely kind of 80s British twist to it, where there's a real gallows humor runs through it all. Chaos is again the ever-present threat, and you know, rears its ugly head in all manner of ways in the old world, but in the way that it was destroyed in the end times. But this setting for the old world is hundreds of years before the first great war against chaos with Magnus the Pious and all the others. So this is kind of, my book doesn't really delve into it, but it's round about the time of the Three Emperors, where the empire was riven by war, the rise of Setra. So it's a very different time from the original old world. So this setting gave us lots of new things to explore, even though they are old things, in the sense of, you know, as we go forward, things like, you know, the race, mortals were not, did not have magic codified in the same way that they do later on, because the elves have yet to come over from Ulthuan and teach them the about the winds of magic. So it's not as regulated as it becomes later on in the world, but there is still oodles of magic, you know, flowing across the world. The winds of magic have not suddenly stopped and so on. So it's still a terrible, grim world of monsters and warring factions and so on. But it's set a long time before the old world, the world that was, kind of thing. So in this setting, to sort of coincide with the release armies of Tomb Kings and Bretonians, Lords of the Lands takes a look at those two factions and pits them against one another.
Yeah, I didn't know about that codifying of magic aspect. That's interesting. But I couldn't help, but the second you said Setra, and then we're talking about going further back, my brain just went, oh, so only has 500,000 titles at this point.
Maybe just one or two more than that. But yeah, he earns at least another one by the end of the book. Although he's not a character in the book, but he does get mentioned, certainly.
All right. Well, Ulrich, since you had the pleasure of actually reading the book, you are free to, now that Graham has given us a wonderful, like, starter point to jump off of for any listeners, you're free to start the conversation whatever way you feel is appropriate.
Well, I think we'll kind of talk a little bit about fantasy, but how did this all come about? Because I'm curious, did you go to Black Library and say, hey, I'm dying to write something for fantasy, Age of Sigmar, what do you got for me? Or did they go, hey, Graham, we loved your last book, do you want to write the first book for the new old world?
It was they came to me with this one, because, you know, I knew the old world was coming back, you know, this at the same time everybody else did, when we saw, you know, the first teasers and what have you before the announcement of it. And, you know, I remember when the old world went away, you know, when it was destroyed and Age of Sigmar and the Mortal Realms were born out of it, you know, I like a lot of people, had a deep pang of sadness when it went away. For, you know, for all its Tolkien-esque bones to it, it had become something uniquely Games Workshop, uniquely Warhammer, and I absolutely loved writing for it. You know, I probably would have written more for the old world had not, you know, the big beefy Horus Heresy elbowed their way to the front of the queue so many times. You know, that's why there was such a long delay between my two High Elf novels, Defenders of Ulthuan and Sons of Illyrian. But yeah, I love the old world. So I was sad when it went away. But, you know, when Age of Sigmar came in and I started reading about that, I was like, okay, you know, this is pretty cool, actually. And it's developed into a crazy good system that I really like. And I've not yet written for Age of Sigmar, but, I would like to at some point. But
Go ahead.
No, as in terms of, you know, stories, novels, characters, I haven't delved into that world. No, I've kept up with it, but I haven't chosen to write something or been chosen to write something, depending on your point of view. But with the old world, it was very much, oh, cool, that's coming back. I can, you know, I've got plenty of ideas for stories set there that I wanted to tell, but never got around to, because the, you know, the world ended, which tends to put a crimp on stories set within that world. You know, I had some great ideas for the Siege of Caraburg to do a dark elf novel, to, so I could finish the triptych of my elf stories and so on. But that never came about. So I was, when the new system was announced, I was like, oh, brilliant, I can get back to doing some of them, because I love that. I find that those stories just really, I wouldn't say easy to write, but there's a flow to them that I get when I'm writing them that often doesn't come with 40K and Heresy, because they're such different, you know, societies and people, and the mindset of the people there are so literally alien to us in the world that they exist in. Whereas, yes, even though there's magic and monsters in the Warhammer world, the people there are more recognizably people that we would know. So the getting into the characters of how they speak, how they move through the world feels easier, even though obviously in a world like that, your mindset is, you know, much the same as anyone else, 40K or otherwise. I want to have enough food to eat. I want a roof over my head. I hope a demon doesn't eat me. The basics, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, as a side note, we've had to slow down a bit for our podcast, but we are still catching up on the Horus Heresy. We are currently reading Dan Abnett's Legion, and as which I'm enjoying thoroughly. And yeah, the Alpha Legion are not relatable, not meant to be.
Nor should they be, exactly. So, you know, with this one, it was a case of one of the editors, Hannah, reached out to me and said, hey, look, we're, you know, obviously, you know, we're relaunching the Warhammer the Old World, and we'd love it if you could do the inaugural book for it, which, you know, I think before the sentence even finished leaving her mouth, I was like, yes.
Yeah, you've been very vocal about your desire to return to the Old World.
Yeah, I don't care what it is. But let me get in the conversation and we can start brainstorming ideas to what this could be. And a lot of that was obviously dependent on what was going to be in the launch as well, because that was going to play a great part in the decision-making process as to what story to tell, what characters to use, what armies would be appearing, what location it would be set in, and so on. So knowing it was going to be Tomb Kings and Bretonians, and looking at the history, you know, the timeline that I'd been given for, you know, the things that were planning to be, you know, released and what was going to happen, what the exact timeline was for there, that naturally suggested where to set it. I mean, I knew it was going to be Tomb Kings Bretonians, but where the story would be and what it would involve was kind of up for debate for the beginning, at the beginning of the process. But once we figured out kind of where in the timeline we needed to slot in, it's, you know, the dominoes started, you know, falling pretty easily after that. I knew, okay, so we're going to go down to the Land of the Dead. It's going to have the Border Princes, parts of the Badlands, and so on. And at some point we'll have to, you know, introduce the notion of Setra Awakened, ready to, you know, begin the, you know, the large scale war on the Old World that he brings.
Yeah, because yeah, the Old World's changed since you last read it, like in a couple minor ways. So that was a factor, I'm sure.
The magic was one of the things. The change in the Bretonian army book that it was the sons and daughters of nobles who could become knights. But generally speaking, it was much the same. The differences were largely cosmetic and largely on the surface, so it didn't require a huge mental gear shift, other than the fact that in this period, chaos is not like the ascendant threat.
They're not creeping around every corner as much.
I mean, there's definitely chaos cultists in probably every village and so on, and there's mutants in the forest and beastmen and so on. But at this point in the timeline, they're not like devouring whole portions of the countryside. There's not huge waves of tribal alliances coming down from the north and so on. But it's still there. But the more corporeal threats of, you know, orcs in the mountains and monsters, they're much more the vein of type of threat that we're more dealing with at this point.
It is funny, and we can kind of address this real quick, because it was one of the first things Ulrich said to me as he started reading the book. But I know you mentioned that, like, sons and daughters. Now, my knowledge of Warhammer Fantasy in the old world is quite limited, but you know, I'm a Total War player, and I went down a wiki hole once about Raponce de Leon and why she was a big deal. But I remember Ulrich sent me this message when he was like maybe a third way through the book, talking about how he liked how they just kind of like naturalistically is like, well, now there's Lady Knights, whatever. It's just part of what's going on.
Well, I mean, one of the, you know, I you know, we knew that would be, if not a sticking point, it would be certainly something that people would notice was different about Bretonians. And I think the best way I found, or I thought, to handle it in the writing of it was not to sort of overtly draw attention to it. It's just, this is how it is.
Yes.
You know, this way of dealing, this way of existing in Bretonia and fighting is just how it is. You know, and you know, the more you make a point of, you know, drawing a circle around it, the more it becomes like this is what the book's about, and it's like that's not what it's about at all.
And that's basically what Ulrich said to me, because he was saying that he liked that it's just there. It's matter of fact. It's not drawn attention to. It's just part of the setting.
Yeah, because it wasn't. There was nothing. You know, despite what a couple of posters have said. You know, there was no woke mind virus. There was no agenda to force female knights down your throats. Ha 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 ha! It was just like, this feels natural, and you know, the women in this book are, you know, they're not wandering around being girl bosses and slapping all the guys around who are incompetent. They're just as competent.
They're just characters.
As the male characters. We're more powerful than you. You know, high fiving with all the other girls, kind of thing. It's just we're here and we're as good as you. And that's it. It's something not drawn attention to, hopefully.
At the same time, every fantasy setting can benefit from a Brienne of Tarth. Just saying.
Yes.
That's true. Yeah.
I was so caught off guard. It caught me for a split second, like, oh, there's Lady Knights now. Oh, that's cool. That's just awesome. Cool. I'm glad we got past that one. And the book moves along. Like, yeah, there was always there. Like, oh, cool. There's an
Which is what I want to do. I just wanted to get that out of the way because, like, again, I think it's cool that it's there. I don't think we need to dwell on it.
Nope. There's another great passage where they're talking about this guy who died and they see his whole future and is like, and he would have met this man and they would have had this romance such that was so great that bards would sing it. Like, cool. They're just like, yeah, there's gay people. We don't care. Part of the setting. Moving it's on.
Part of the fabric. Moving through.
And it's this perfect thing of, yeah, we are updating and moving through. If this is a problem for you, maybe this isn't the setting for you, but no one in this universe cares. This is not an issue because it shouldn't be an issue.
So real quick, we've been touching on some specifics, and we did a general. So I want to kind of do a little in between. We mentioned that it's Bretonia and Tomb Kings because it's partly, or, you know, dictated, for like a rare word, about the launch armies. Or so for those who are, you know, maybe have heard of it, but don't, can you give like a brief, like, what's the elevator pitch for this book, considering its plot?
Well, at its core, you could say it's the 10,000 in the Land of the Dead. And for those not up to date on their Xenophon, this is basically a Bretonian army heads into the Land of the Dead to rescue a lost prince. And, you know, hilarity ensues when things go terribly wrong at every stage of the event. So, yes, two noble knights who have had a falling out, without going into too deep, because that plays a part in the story, but they've had a major falling out in the past. One of them was exiled to the border princes, or self-exiled themselves to the border princes. But he has a debt. He is owed a debt by his former knightly lord friend, and he calls in that debt to say, you need to come and help me, because we're going to the Land of the Dead to rescue my son, and you owe me big time. So even from the get-go, there's tension in the wind, because these are unreliable allies to one another. And that's not the best situation to be in when you're going into a hostile state. You know, you want somebody you know is going to watch your back. And these two forces are already setting out on the first foot with bad blood between them, which we don't learn what that is until much later in the book. But it plays a part for quite a number of the characters.
Yeah, this book is just like stacked character tensions, because on top of the lords, you also have one of the knights who is reunited with his childhood love, but she's now a handmaiden of the lady, And everyone in that circle is like, listen, we know how you feel, but she belongs to the lady and you need to respect that. So there's that whole kind of ongoing tension that's great.
Yeah, I mean, the one of the things I always like to do with characters is try and find ways to put rocks in their backpack to make their life more difficult. You know, a lot of the times you're looking for, when you've got a story or a situation that you're going to put your characters through, one of the things you're looking for is, okay, who's the worst person to meet this challenge for whatever reason, whether it's physically, whether it's emotionally, whatever it is, you want to make things as hard as possible for your characters. So, you know, having the character of Varro, who's, yeah, like you say, he meets his soulmate, the girl of his dreams from back in the day, but now she's one of the handmaidens of the lady, so that's a distraction. They're here on a mission where the allied army with them might not be that friendly to them. They're in hostile territory. There are, you know, knights errant who are being very silly and stupid and reckless doing things. There's all sorts of buried tensions that come to light in the story that, you know, just conspire to make things really difficult for everybody at every turn, which is, you know, what you want, because you've got to put your character through the ringer, because if everything's too easy, nothing at the ending feels earned.
Well, it makes for a very compelling story, because it's like you're watching all these people struggle, and then you just keep introducing new challenges, like, okay, they'll make it through this, and then you're like, and then this happened, like, oh, of course, that's
a terrible thing.
Yeah, that tracks. They were lucky, they had their 5-minute break. Okay, now introduce next controversy.
Yeah, and some of the trials that they undergo are ones that they bring with them. Yep. Although those are the ones that, you know, happen to them on route as they lose people, as they're injured, as they lose their mounts, which, you know, is a big deal for some of the knights. For all the knights, losing a horse is a big deal. And there's a character who's deaf, there's a character who's gravely injured later on, and yeah, there's all sorts of things, terrible. Every time I thought, I think they're having a bit easy now, let's throw in some terrible misfortune to happen to them that now just makes it to the point where you're like, well, I don't see how they can possibly escape this, or I don't see how they can possibly overcome that.
I really like the idea of popping rocks in the backpack, because everything you've described so far sounds very Sisyphusian, so rock is the appropriate imagery.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, that was from it was a talk the guys from Telltale Games did up at GDC one year about their Walking Dead games and how they'd, you know, they'd loaded the choices you had to make at the different points to make each one like a moment of agony. So characters with rocks in their backpack, that's always been my mantra when I heard that, because I thought, oh, that's good. That's good. That's what I should be doing. Nobody, you know, wants the Peter Perfect character. You just want messed up, broken, insecure, you know, neurotic folk going through this adventure, because they're the ones that you'll have the most fun writing, and they're the ones you'll have hopefully the readers will have the most fun reading about them overcoming whatever obstacle they either self-imposed carry or is, you know, heaped upon them by the author.
So coming back to fantasy in general, I mean, returning to it, I know that there's, as you talked about, you know, because of the whole army launch thing, certain level of, you know, beginning, something to jump off of. Was there anything, just for my curiosity, anything that like was told to you as part of your writing process, or that you came up with yourself, that you surprised yourself with, or that you were surprised, something about the setting that is new or different, that someone who coming back to it 10 years later, like, oh, well, this is, my understanding has shifted, or I've learned something new?
Yeah, I mean, taking it, there was nothing beyond Tomb Kings, Bretonians, Border Princes, Land of the Dead. That was literally the guidance. It was like, do a Warhammer, and these are the things, the toys you've got to play with. Everything else was, you know, came from my own, you know, my own invention sort of thing. In terms of, yeah, I mean, I think the what I had fun with was taking a story into a place that was essentially lawless, you know, because all the other books I've written have been in the old world. You know, they've been in Kislev, where there's a city, there's a watch, there are rules. You know, not everybody obeys them, but they are there. The High Elf books were in a land entirely regulated by you know, high elven laws, how things behave and so on. So it was nice to go into a land where none of that, all the safeties, you know, and all, as always with Warhammer, safety is always deeply in quotes. But all the sort of guardrails were gone. There was no cities, none of the cultures that you're so used to leaning on in a Warhammer novel that you wouldn't, you'd be able to bring them into the story and, you know, okay, well, I know this thing exists here, so I can use that in the story, or I can bounce characters off it or what have you. Whereas this being essentially the desert and the Badlands, where very little, I mean, there's been the Blood in the Badlands supplement, but not that much has been written about it. So I kind of had a free hand to invent a lot of stuff down there. And, you know, there were bits off the maps and so on. You know, I was delving into maps from, you know, a dozen different publications that have been released over the last 30, 40 years that, you know, oh, that's interesting. I don't know, what does that mean? That could be something that I could draw on for a location, a scene, a character beat or what have you. But just there was a freedom to writing in that space that sometimes you don't get because, you know, when you're in an established place that people understand and know, there's certain expectations that either this will happen or that couldn't happen here. Whereas writing in the Land of the Dead, you were like, you could essentially do anything, in as long as it still fitted the lore and the IP and so on. But in terms of actual things that happened there, you know, there was very few guardrails on that at all. So that was fun to do, to, you know, say, okay, I can do anything I want here, really.
It feels like that. Like, that was one of my big takes, was like, this feels big and grandiose in a way that a lot of older Warhammer's Fantasy didn't. Like, we're in the Empire, we're in the city, this is our zone of interest. We're on Ulthuan, we are in this zone of interest. This was like, we're going to start in Bretonnia, and then we're going to go down to the Border Princes, and then we're going to come across, and we're going to go down through the Badlands into the Tomb Kings, and it's this whole big, wide swath of story that really feels like a grand adventure.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the feelings, because I wrote down, you know, a bunch of like key thematics that I wanted for this one, you know, because every book you start with a number of hopes and expectations that you want to try and achieve with a book, or, you know, ideals. You start off thinking, yeah, this is a book where I want the audience to feel this when they finish it, or to have been emotionally broken by chapter two or whatever it is. And one of the things I had for this was, like, I wanted it to be kind of epic in scale in terms of how far the characters travel, the scale of events that happen to them, the variety of events that happen to them, the foes they will face. So I wanted it to feel like you had gone a long, long journey with these characters, that you had walked alongside them all the way from Bretonnia back around again through all the horrors they encounter on the way, and that you felt, this is big. This Warhammer World stuff is big. And that was a feeling that I really wanted the first book that was coming out with the game to really get that across to people who maybe hadn't, you know, experienced much in the way of Warhammer, the old world before, that yes, it's all in one planet, but it's still big, it's still epic.
No, this book does a great job of conveying.
Excellent. Thank you.
It is funny, you got a little bit into two different questions. I know one of Ulrich's and one of mine that was coming up. Like, I, for instance, was going to eventually ask you about, because I know we've talked a bit about in the previous times we talked to you about the somewhat collaborative process when it came to writing the Heresy things. But your description right now of this book sounds a lot more like you were giving an edict and then a set of toys and told to go wild.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the Heresy was very much a collaborative thing. It was, and that's, I loved that part of it, you know, getting everybody together in the writer's room to break out what was going to be the next bunch of books, and smaller rooms we would break out a couple together at one time, because, you know, the folks I was working with on those books were just brilliant people. They're wonderful humans and great to collaborate with. This one, this is very much a, and certainly the writing and the planning of it was very much a solo effort. Although obviously I did have, you know, conversations and guidance from Hannah, the editor, on this one. But yeah, it's a strange feeling, because you go from one where there's a lot of eyes on Heresy and Siege stuff and so on, that you know, has to match up as closely as possible and as practical with what has gone before, whereas this is a setting and a world and a story that kind of doesn't have it, any other sort of story peers in the sense of ones that are set around that time. I mean, the closest is probably Gav's Slaves to Darkness trilogy that was set previous to the conventional timeline of the old world was, but largely from, I mean, this is the synopsis I did for the first synopsis I did for this was quite different because, like I say, at the time when I was pitching that one, I didn't know who the launch armies were going to be. So it was set fully in the Badlands, very much a sort of kind of Dirty Dozen style thing, which still may be part of, if you know, if I do. I mean, the way I left Lords of the Lance is you could, you know, walk away from the ending and go, cool, now the events of the games and the seasons will unfold. Or you could have a second book or a third book and so on. So a bunch of the ideas that, you know, were in the first synopsis will probably resurface if I do another one again.
Room for growth. Always good thing.
Never be too tidy with your backstory.
That's the Games Workshop motto. And always leave room. Leave the little asterisk of...
Absolutely.
That next time. Told us
that. All right, Ori, I could read off one of your bullet points, but I want to take your thunder from you. Why don't you... One of your questions.
Well, let's throw one in because our friend Bert Jennings loves Bretonnia, was heartbroken when the old world ended, and he had his Bretonnian army he didn't get to play. And then when he heard Bretonnia was coming back, he was so excited. And then when he heard... the first book out was a Bretonnia book. He was even more excited. And then his entire order got back laid when we had that big snowstorm. So hadn't had a chance to read the book. And I said, hey man, we're going to be talking with Graham McNeil about this book. Are there any Bretonnian specific questions you're wanting to ask him? And he gave us two really good ones that I do think are pertinent to the discussion.
Okay.
But hold on before you ask those questions, because the first one looks like a giant spoiler.
It isn't. So we'll tread carefully around this.
Okay, well, I will try and tread carefully in my answer and hope I can actually answer it.
So he said, with the end times, is revealed that the infamous Lady of the Lake was simply the human face of the Wood Elf Goddess. How did this reveal impact Bretonnia's faith in history? And I knew that going in. I think a lot of us knew that going into this book. And when you mention the lady, it's like, okay, I can kind of see various reads. I'm curious how that factored or if that even factored.
It, in terms of the plotting of the book, no, it didn't at all. Because, you know, at this stage of Bretonnian history, the lady is theirs. You know, she's this ethereal goddess figure to them, purity unmatched and so on. But I wanted to make a nod to what we as, you know, old readers will probably have remembered from the old times, or hint to those folks who maybe haven't seen that, because remember that was, you know, that was 10 years ago now, like the scene where they've escaped from Khemri and they're tending to one of the wounded handmaidens. There's a scene that happens there that definitely makes a tip of the cap to that notion. Yes.
Yeah. There's a nice little subtle things like, I see exactly what he's doing. It's like, well, if you want to interpret it this way, there's that. And if you want to interpret it this way, there's that. Like, perfect, you know, Games Workshop, like, hey, it's up to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You don't, I think there's less drama and less interesting spaces to mine when you say, here is the answer. It is X. When you give people enough to hopefully sort of follow the breadcrumbs and theory craft, then that's much more interesting because people talk about it. They try and decide. They have discussions, you know, that go on for years and years. You know, the two lost legions, there are no wolves in Fenris. Did Magnus do something wrong? You know, these are discussions that will go on for, have gone on for years and will probably continue to do so.
Who is Alpharius?
giving people the breadcrumbs of lore to discuss, to debate, to argue about, that's far more interesting.
Yeah, and we've long been proponents of make your own canon, which is, if you don't like something, just ignore it. There's countless stuff in 40K like, yeah, I don't like that. I'm just going to ignore that because it doesn't work for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fine line to walk, though, because you have to be careful that you're not just vague for the sake of being vague, and nobody can even begin to think of what it could be, because it could be anything. So
that's how I feel about Alpha Legion. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about them a lot with our book club, and it's like, I love Alpha Legion, but the vagary of on vagary drives me crazy sometimes.
Mm, yeah,
and it's funny because
the breadcrumbs have to be a bit more solid.
Yeah, and it's funny because I know that in regards to the end times and stuff that happened in the end times, there is a complicated relationship with the readership. I've not read it myself, but we've had a few people on who were like actively part of the community when the end times was happening. I know there's a lot of stuff in it that is, you know, very well liked, and there's also a lot of stuff that isn't very well liked. So when you're figuring out like what kind of things to allude to, I can imagine that might be an interesting kind of thing to juggle.
Yeah, I mean, like the way I look at it, and this will sound in some ways selfish, in some ways it will sound like, well, obviously, is that, you know, I choose to shine the spotlight on or be vague around or in, you know, encounter those bits of story that I like, you know, because ultimately I'm writing a book for one person, me. I'm writing the book that I want to read, that I want to see out there, that I think is good. And, you know, because I've played and play Warhammer and 40K, have done for decades now. So I'm a hobbyist and a player as well as the writer in it. So I know the things I like. I've played this for long enough that I know there's moments that there's things in this history that I like, things that I like less. But when I'm choosing what to focus on for a story, I'm going to cherry pick literally the bits that I really like. Unfortunately, you know, 90% of everything we've put, you know, that's been put out in the stories, I'm like, even if it's not like, yeah, I would have done it differently, but I like what you did with it still. So yeah, the notion of who the lady is was one that I thought that was quite clever, and I liked how it changed the lens of how you saw the relationship between Bretonnia and Athel Lauren. So that felt like it was a fun thing to play with. But yeah, I pull out the things that I found interesting and exciting and that would hopefully add some, you know, grist to the mill of the story I was going to tell here.
I'm very, very elated to hear that, because I'm a big proponent of the concept that a creator, an artist, as it were, in some ways needs to be their piece's biggest fan.
Yeah. Well, it's when somebody asks you at the time, you know, when what's your favorite book? And it's like, well, it's the one I'm writing now. Because it has to be. You have to be a little in love with the story you're telling, with the characters, even as you do horrible things to them. You have to hope that your ambition for the story and your taste is refined or developed enough that you can do a thing that will hopefully resonate with the people who are reading it. Because, you know, having been part of it for so long in terms of writing it, you know, in terms of the rules, the codexes and what have you, or novels to follow, I'm a hobbyist and a gamer, so I like to write the things that excite me as one of those people. So if I was a reader, I'm hopefully going to be reading this book and going, this is cool, seeing Pegasus Knights doing their thing, or having the lady inspire the knights before the charge, that sort of thing. You know, those are moments that I see in the army books and go, that would be cool to see in a story form. You know, it's a rule mechanic, but that would be cool to see how that actually translates in a story with dialogue and beats that you want to see.
Yeah, it really comes across. Like, a lot of this is like, this is just Bretonnia's greatest hits and getting a great sense of who they are. And this is like, I think, a great introductory, like, hey, you have a vague idea of what the old world is. Here's kind of a primer on this faction of their knights. And they have, it gets, oh, they're very Arthurian knights because it's all about the lady. Okay, cool. It's a great primer. It doesn't feel like, okay, so here's all the backstory you need on the old world beforehand, and here's your Bretonnia primer, and here's your. No, this is a great fantasy novel first, and a great Warhammer fantasy novel second.
Yeah, cool. It was, again, not really a brief or anything like that, but it was like, remember that a lot of people who will read this have never read Warhammer the Old World fiction before. So as much as there's a level of assumed knowledge that I'm expecting, inverted commas, the audience to have. But
at this point, it's at least fair to say that they've been playing Total War, because a lot of people have.
there's a level of expectation you can have, even if not a Warhammer fan, that people know what, you know, knights on horseback and that sort of chivalric code with the Lady of the Lake. You know, we all know what that is, even if we've never picked up a Warhammer book before. You know, we know that undead skeletons rising from the desert are bad news and you should probably avoid them if you can. So there's a level of genre knowledge that I think it's safe to expect anyone who picks up this book will have. So you don't need to retread that old ground because they can get it, or things that aren't maybe as, you know, directly lifted from a common understanding, things that are more uniquely Warhammer, you know, they're, you develop them through story, through characters, through action, through, you know, context clues within what people are saying, what they're doing, that they can figure out. You know, you can provide all the dots and then they will join them together to figure, oh, that's what this is about the world. And that feels more organic and more, you know, more natural to get your exposition over that way, there, rather than a 4-page intro to Bretonian hierarchies of knights at the beginning, which I didn't want to do at all.
Yeah.
You know, I love me some Game of Thrones, but the man can spend 3 pages describing flags. It, you don't need to do that.
Yeah, and, you know, don't get me wrong. There's some scenarios where that kind of thing is absolutely right. Like there's one of Chris Raitt's books where he talks, there's like 3 or 4 pages where one of the characters is talking about the different qualities of different kinds of vellum. Or, you know, it's the Patrick Bateman thing where he spends 7 pages talking about how he ties a particular knot in his tie, or why Huey Lewis and the News are the best band ever. And they exemplify something of a character or a moment. So that was, you know, they're appropriate in those sort of scenarios, but I felt for this book, it didn't need to be like that. And I'd much prefer the exposition come through action and deed rather than just lots of, you know, pages and pages of text.
There's a little bit of that in like the getting the army together and like, okay, over here, Rail Knight and his pilgrims. Over here, Knights Errants. Over here, Pegasus Knights. All right, that's everyone you need to know. You've got a vague idea of who they are, their colors, yeah. And they're off.
Yeah, it, just enough to set the, you know, to put it in the reader's mind, these people exist, but don't worry, we'll come to them when it's their time to shine. We'll see more of them. And when you see them doing their thing, you'll be like, oh, cool. That's what these guys are and what they do and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I only bring up this next question as a way to add another, because we've spent some time talking about the way that it has felt different from, say, Writing for Heresy, the way it's felt different from 40K in general. And I want to add a third dimension to that concept of like what makes the old world unique. And that for anyone who doesn't know, because I have several friends who didn't know this, Graham has spent quite a bit of time as the principal narrative writer for the world building team at Riot, which is the League of Legends company. That means that he spent a lot of time in a different fantasy world, but it's also a fantasy world with some sci-fi aspects and some similarities. And that's, you know, that's a pretty high level for dealing with the world building team principal narrative writer. That's a very appropriate title. And so going from that back into the old world, what sort of different challenges or different feelings for that this kind of world building or this kind of writing in comparison to what you were doing before?
Well, the world building we were doing at Riot to begin with was, we weren't literally building the world from scratch. I mean, when I joined, a lot of it was already there. But to be fair, a lot of what was there felt a little disjointed from each other. So you had, you know, Viking land in the north, Egypt land to the south, knights in armor here, steampunk world in the middle. And a lot of it felt very disconnected. So our job at the beginning, you know, it wasn't just me, obviously. There was other writers, there was artists, editors, and what have you, was figuring out how to make the world feel like one place, you know, like it wasn't just theme park world stuck together and you could walk from one to the other sort of thing, that the world had a credible feel to it. And a lot of what was in Runeterra, the Riot IP, it was very much flavored by the champions. The champions are the backbone of League of Legends, and they are they're almost like the primarchs of the planet, so to speak. They're not literally that, but they are beings of greater power by far than, you know, the ordinary man in the street kind of thing. So the world was very much set up and driven by what they do a lot of the time. You know, as Warhammer's, it has its heroes and so on, but it's a world where armies matter, mass bodies of people matter, where the little guy can make a difference. And whereas Riot is very much focused on the champions and what they do and how they change the world. Because a lot of the champions are driven by the needs of the game. What the game, because the game is the prime driver of much if not all of what League does. So the champions are crafted for the game, and then as the narrative builds for them, we figured out ways to, how would that affect the world? What would be the effect of this new person arriving in the world who has got all these powers or has had this backstory? What does that mean? So it was a different world, and Runeterra is built around those characters and what they do, as opposed to, the world being a cruel and horrible dark place where you could die at any minute. There was a far more, if not optimistic view, there was a far more, this could be a nice place. There are parts of this world which would be lovely to live in. Whereas the Warhammer world is kind of, everywhere sucks.
Yeah, you don't want to live here. That part's also bad.
Yeah, it's like every time you see those, the memes going around Twitter about, you're now living in the last fictional world you read. And it's always like generally fairly pleasant. Then you get to Warhammer and everything's in flames, skeletons and demons. And you're like, yeah, I don't want to live in that one.
If I might ask about to dig into that just a little bit more, to go from, because I don't know what principal narrative writer of the world building team fully translate. I've read some of the short stories that you wrote for the characters that I enjoyed thoroughly. I remember reading a Jinx one that was one of my favorite ones. But to go from that position to just novel writing, what are the kind of differences in what you're doing in process?
Well,
I know you just went all about the champion stuff, but I mean more kind of like writing a novel versus that.
I mean, writing a novel is much more of a solo effort, obviously. I mean, yes, you have editors, beta readers and what have you, but it's generally speaking, it's just you in a chair for several months until the thing is done. Whereas working in video games is one of the most collaborative efforts that I've ever been involved in, because the dependencies in video games are enormous in terms of audio, animation, VFX, art, narrative, gameplay, design. There's so much goes into working in a video game where, you cannot think individually, because you've got to think of not only the product you're making, but how does that affect 10 other products that are happening all around the company. And when I started there, it was a shock to the system, because, I had 10 years of being a freelancer as an author on my own. Sure, we collaborated a lot on the Heresy stuff, but you still had those months ass in chair writing a book. So when I first came to Riot, it was very much like the feral child raised by wolves brought back to the city kind of thing. And now I have to wear clothes and I have to talk to actual humans during the day. So that took a bit of getting used to. But actually, luckily, the folk I was working with in world building were just amazing people. And I loved that team. There were some great people to work with, collaborate with, and learn from.
But you probably enjoyed to get some of that solo novel time you've described.
There is, it's an undeniable fact that there is a great deal of satisfaction sometimes to be gained from being king of all you survey and the world bends to my whims of whatever I want to happen in it, within reason, because you are obviously still, you're still writing in a shared IP that, other people have to play in. There's a persistence to the IP that I can't go in and say, I kill Setra. I was like, well, that's just not going to happen because...
That's just kind of important, and
he might be used by other people at some point. So
yeah, you can't write in Lord McNeil who rides on a great dragon from Bretonnia.
You know what? Stay tuned.
Oh no, I'd love to hear that. Give me that model.
but yeah, right. Video games certainly, and Riot is massively everything is massively intertwined. there. So, you know, you've got to be very deliberate, very careful with whatever changes you might want to make or whatever stories you want to tell. You've got to, you know, run that past lots of different teams and people to make sure, make sure you're not clashing with anything anybody else is doing, but also are there ways to collaborate? Are there ways that, that thing you're doing will amplify ours if we can link some story beats or a character or something like that? So I don't want to make it sound like it was all like, oh my God, everything was just so snarled up. It was great. And it came about mostly organically. Like you'd be at the Bilgewater Brew, it's like the on-site coffee shop, bump into somebody and be chatting away, and they'd be, oh yeah, we're doing such and such. And I'm like, oh, I was just talking to so-and-so and they're doing a project about this. You guys should talk. Or I would find something that, oh, I'm doing this. I'll send you the doc of whatever it is I'm working on. So it did happen quite organically. But yeah, it's the web of things that are all connected in video games are way more complex than writing a novel solo. But it was fun. You know, it was fun finding those areas of collaboration and adding things that you hadn't even begun to think of, but that thing you're doing, that's really cool. I could add this here, and that becomes something else, and it elevates what you're doing, and it hopefully, you know, helps elevate what the other team are doing, because the players out in the world look at that and see, these guys talk to each other, and this makes sense with that product. And yeah, it's just finding, like we did with the Heresy, finding the connective tissue that links various expressions of an IP in whatever form it is, however massive or just fleetingly it is, they're just all things that just really add to that texture of a world that feels real, that the people who make it care about it, which everybody does. You know, whether you're a solo novelist or you're working as part of a 100-strong team in video games, everybody cares about the things they're making. They want to make it gooder.
It is something of an ephemeral quality, but I have always been a proponent of the idea that you can usually sense, whether you realize it or not, sincerity and genuineness from a piece on the behalf of the author. If the person writing it cares what they're writing, you'll be able to tell.
Oh, I 100% I agree with that. Yes.
And I think Bert would skin me if I didn't let Ulrich ask his second question before the end of this recording.
Bert, you really gave us some tricky questions to ask. This is also one I'm curious your response. And he asked, were there any old world factions you wanted to write Bretonnia fighting but couldn't find a way to? Because you've talked previously, like, you wanted to write Bretonnia. Like, no, knights in shining armor, that sounds fun.
Not particularly for this book. Because, like, say, when the brief came down, Bretonnian's Tomb Kings, I know I wrote a Bretonnian knight before in Guardians of the Forest, but I hadn't written a Bretonnian novel. But Tomb Kings, I'd never ever touched them. So that was fun to do, even though they're not the main protagonists of the story at all. They serve purely as antagonists in this. But, you know, they were fun to write. And because I'd never used them in a story before, it was like, oh, cool, that's great. I'd love to do something with them. You know, I managed to sneak in some orcs at the end of it, so that was fun, and some monster and ghouls and flesh eaters, also good fun to use. The one faction that I haven't yet touched is dark elves. Beyond, I think there was a short story, yeah, Kinstrife, the Prelude.
That's a really good one. I just read that one.
Yeah, the Prelude story before the two high elf novels has done, you know, it's a raid on Naggaroth. Sorry, Naggarond. But yeah, I'd love to put them in there, but there's no way that was going to fly. They're too far away, and they're not, you know, one of the prime factions for this iteration yet.
Well, I'll just keep my ear to the ground for anything Skaven related.
Yeah, oh, well, if ever I get to do, I mean, I did the Sigmar trilogy for the Time of Legends, and I've long harangued people that, hey, you know what, I pitched out the ideas for the next three novels for the Sigmar trilogy, and one of them is going to be a full-on Empire Skaven novel. So if that ever happens, you will get to see your rat boys there.
Ooh. Absolutely. I love it. I don't know what story it was in. I just remember that when we were talking with, like, Loremaster of Sotek, he mentioned some story about, like, a Tomb King's pyramid getting blown up by a like team of SWAT Skaven, and I was like, I want to know more about that.
So, that sounds cool, man. I would buy that for a dollar.
Now, so this last question we'll just kind of end on and wrap up here. What's your favorite part about writing in the old world, and maybe even coming back to the old world? Like, what was your most like, oh boy, I can't wait to write this again? I mean, aside from the fact it's a really fun world to play in.
Yeah, it's a fun world to live in and explore. For me, it was the dialogue was the thing that I knew I was going to have fun with, because again, the style of dialogue in 40K tends to be a bit more formal, a bit more, you know, it's got that gothic sensibility to it. You know, the ritualized dogmatism of that world does some, in some ways, translate into the dialogue. Whereas the old world, because the humans in that are much, I feel much more recognizably human to us, that you get to put things in their mouth that are, you would never get to see in a 40K novel. You can have expressions or a casualness or a free flowing naturalistic vibe to the dialogue that often eludes people in the 40K universe. So coming back to that kind of style of dialogue was really fun, you know, because it felt much more like the kinds of things you could imagine a human saying, which often in 40K doesn't always prove to be the case. I mean, deliberately so. So the dialogue was always fun, and you could get to have you know, you could have characters experiencing things that we don't often see in 40K, like romantic love. You know, there's a couple of characters in this book who, you know,
are, I'm not going to spoil that for anybody, but that was my favorite. Wait, what's happening? Oh, I can see where this is going now. Oh, this is okay. Totally, yeah. Caught me off guard, because it's like brutal slaughter, brutal slaughter, brutal slaughter, tender romance. I'm like, oh, that's nice.
You know, I've already been a fan of your work that I've read, so I already wanted you to do some writing for Age of Sigmar additional to what you're doing. But now that you've said that specifically, I couldn't help but think of there's a Hammer and Bolter episode that's all about a Stormcast Eternal who basically is just a giant like bard character who charms his way through an Orcam. And his dialogue felt so. Anyway, your answer made me like want to hear you write for a situation like that.
You know, I remember Vince Rossbaum, you know, Black Library's guy in America for so many years before he went on to Winged Hussar. He and I had always pitched that before, you know, we should have alongside Warhammer crime, Warhammer horror, we should have Warhammer romance. I mean, that sounds like I think there's a market for that. But yeah, because having humans able to have human emotions that we would recognize is fun to do in the old world. So having those two characters particularly experience that and then kind of pull the rug out from the end of it was kind of fun to do.
Well, it's funny because Ulrich and I have had a few recordings where we've gone out of our way to say that one of our... Oh, you still there, Grim?
Okay. Yeah, sorry, I was clicking in the... to move the window around, and I think I actually clicked on one of the icons, but yes.
No worries. But I was going to say, Org and I have had this thing where we have said that we get frustrated at times when it seems like there are contingents of the audience who want to limit Warhammer in some way. Like, we feel that it's vast, and it can facilitate so many more kind of stories than just the one kind of story. So yeah, hearing... idea of romance set in Warhammer or comedy, like a pure comedy, like, you know, any number of these genres, like any genre that I feel like you could see or think of, I can imagine. I'm a musical fan. I would love to see a Warhammer musical.
You know, this is a world of magic and monsters. Literally anything can happen. And when, you know, I don't want to use the word limited, but there are lines of the box of the playground. But anything can happen within that, and these are human beings, and they run the gamut of all the emotions that we would recognize. So why shouldn't we see those sort of things in a book? And one of the things that's fun to do with the books that you know the game is war and it's fighting and it's a battle. The books allow you to take those characters into places that, you know, aren't suitable for the tabletop. You know, we get to see life after the battle, life before the battle, you know, the effects of that. I mean, that was something, you know, like one of the characters essentially has a panic attack after a fight scene. Because again, these are ordinary people. And they, you know, this character in particular has, he's never been in a battle before. And when there's swords slashing and blood flying, the effect of that afterwards was like, holy shit, this is something, you know, we don't often see in Warhammer, because all the characters there are, you know, giant warriors or monster slayers or trained in the combat pits since they were babies kind of thing. So I just, you know, again, I thought it'd be interesting. It's something we have. I always look for the gaps in a lot of things. Like, what haven't we seen before? Like, well, what if there's a character who's thrust into this moment, or who has chosen in this case to seek this out? And when he finds it, it's not all that they thought it was going to be. They were expecting the bardic tales of glory and honor and heroism. But actually, when you're in the thick of a fight, it's bloody and nasty and brutal and horrible. And seeing that traumatizes him to a degree. And again, like I say, I thought we don't often see that in a Warhammer book. I mean, you know, he comes through it and becomes the hero, you know, becomes heroic through the course of the story. But I thought that would be interesting to see if any one of us was faced by that sort of thing, we would freak the hell out.
Yeah. Well, it works so well because it's Bretonians and they go to war in these great, beautiful, bright, shining armor and the tabards and the flags, like, oh, war is this glorious thing. And he gets there and like, no, it's bloody and messy and horrible and terrifying. It's not like an Empire guy that's, you know, he's been living on the streets. He's seen terrible stuff. This is, no, this was a noble son and he had this glorious life and this was his reality shock.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, I feel like I got the main stuff on my head out there. So, Ulrich, do you have any final things to ask our illustrious guest?
Not without really spoiling the book. It's just, we want more. And we know you don't get to make that decision. But I'm always happy when you write a new book. And I was super excited. I'm like, oh boy, a new book in fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly, I mean, I'm no longer with Riot now. So the options to do more fantasy, more books in the Warhammer space is now greatly increased. So like I say, I left that book at a point where absolutely, yeah, more stories can be told of these characters. Some of them get to a place where it's like, okay, this has happened to you. How is that going to affect your life now? What avenues of drama now does that open for us now that you are so profoundly changed by that thing that happened to you, or that moment that you experienced, or this thing that you saw? Because I've certainly got ideas for where I would take a second book utilizing those characters, but I'll need to speak to Hannah and the rest of the team there, see what there's a thirst for.
Well, I mean, we know the Tomb Kings are coming to Bretonnia. We know that is the narrative thrust. I mean, yeah. Why not? Let's see this all the way through. And I know Games Workshop has said they don't plan to do anything with Cathay and Kislev right now, but come on, you made all that work to develop it. Let's go tell some stories over there as well.
And also, I didn't get to check numbers or anything, but I assume my inability to find this book means that it is sold well.
I assume so. I mean, it came out beginning of January. At the end, well, later this year when, you know, the 6th monthly sales figures comes out, I'll see how well it did. But I think the special edition certainly sold out very quickly, as these things are wont to do. And yeah, I mean, I'm sad you couldn't get hold of the book, but I'm glad it sold out well enough that became a problem for you.
And hopefully I'll get to it eventually.
Hopefully that's simply a case of people buying it rather than some terrible supply chain issue.
Fair. All right, well, we've had a wonderful discussion. We always love to have you, Graham. It's been three great discussions. Yeah, hope to have more good ones in the future. And it's at this point, as a thank you for coming and talking to us about this, that we give you the special soapbox, the special spotlight, where you can plug anything you want to plug. You want to plug the book we've been talking about? That's great. You want to plug something else? Also great. All yours.
Yeah, well, at this point, I'm very much in the space of, yeah, please, if you can, and you can find one, pick up a copy of Lords of the Lands, because I would love for the first book to do really well to the point where Black Library come back and say, holy shit, this book sold gangbusters. We need to do a second one. That would be a great result for me. So please, if you haven't already picked up a copy and you like a bit of Old World, then hie ye to the nearest friendly local gaming store or Games Workshop store, buy yourself a copy, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. And then just, you know, fingers crossed we get another one, and I'll see what's next for me at Black Library.
More Uriel of Ventress.
That too. I mean, when I spoke to Tom at Black Library last week, and literally off the top of my head, without even thinking about it, there were like 15 things I could say, right? Well, any one of these we could do. New Uriel trilogy, Forges of Mars 2 trilogy, or ooh, Warhammer Crime, Warhammer Horror, New Uriel trilogy, that Time of Legends trilogy I've got mapped out. Maybe if Warhammer the Old World is successful and people like it and want to delve back into the ancient ages of that time, maybe that could be a thing. No idea what the plans are going forward, but I have a ton of projects that I could pick up tomorrow.
As a big fan of noir myself, you can tell them, you know, at least one fan who thinks Warhammer Crime sounds particularly great.
Yes.
Warhammer Horror, I want to see what Eldritch Nightmare you unleash.
It's a toss-up between the two, because I did the Colonel's Monograph for the horror line, and that I had a really good time writing that. That was one that just flowed, despite, you know, what we were just saying about, you know, 40K can be, you know, challenging in some ways for the pacing of it and the writing of it. That one just flowed straight onto the page, and I love doing it. I mean, that story certainly is a one-off. There's no, you know, serialization of that one. But the Warhammer Crime stories I've done with Colbrand, that certainly I could... I've got ideas as to how to expand their stories into a novel. But horror, I mean, horror's always been really close to my heart in terms of writing. So, but yeah, there's loads of things potentially in the works. You know, Battle for McCrag is one I've always had my eye on.
Oh, that would be good.
Thing. You know, there's nothing set in stone. We haven't had those discussions yet, but I've more ideas than I will probably have life left in me to write.
Yeah,
we won't hold you to any of them, but we'll hold on to our hope.
Yeah, because just the other day,
they're all ideas yet to be fitted into a strategy or a plan or a range. Yeah, everything is nothing until it's something.
Yeah, just the other day, I completed the fourth company of the Ultramarines. Everybody's there. And I'm like, this is perfect until Graham releases the next book and Pacinius has crossed the Rubicon Primaris and I've got to redo his model. I'm like, well, mixed blessing there.
It's always nice to have a new hobby project.
Yep. You know what? You know, you can just get... I built a couple Uriels before he got his official model. It's okay.
All right, Ulrich, we could talk Graham's ear off all night. I know we can.
So I was just getting beeped. I wasn't looking at my time, my watch. I was getting beeped from it. So I was like, no way.
No worries. I'm just trying to keep us on something of a track.
Something of a timeline, yes.
Yeah, if we go off into 40K, we'll be here all night.
To talk to you guys tonight.
Yeah, it's been great. All right, Ulrich, I think you can take us into an outro, buddy.
Yep. Thank you all for listening. Special thanks to Graham for coming back on and talking with us. Be sure to like, share, subscribe, do all the things, because that is the meat and potatoes of podcasts. The algorithm is not our friend. We literally are reliant on you to share it with other people.
And over platform you're currently listening to this on, thank you for doing that. If that platform itself was somehow compromised and there's a different platform you'd like us to be on, tell us about it. And if it's feasible, we'll make it happen.
As always, this has been Lord Commander Ulrich.
And his shield brother, Axel Wright.
And until next time, may the dice roll in your favor.